of mine. Never forget.
You're listening to Jackie Patru and Sweet Liberty. And now, here's your host, Jackie Patru.
Roll away the dawn. Roll away the dawn and let me see the land of the free. Has anything changed at all? Sweet liberty, sweet liberty is in our hands. It's part of the plan, or is it a state of mind? Horses and men, horses and men are on the field. They didn't yield. Many have fallen here. Never forget. Never.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us tonight on Sweet Liberty. Sorry once again for that delay. I kept dialing in and I wasn't getting a ring. Nothing was happening. This is, it's just kind of ridiculous. Thank you for being with us tonight. This is Wednesday, and it would be the 5th. Yes, the 5th of October in the year 2005. And for those of you who haven't been tuned in, I will just announce once again that as of next Wednesday, this broadcast will be going off the air. And it's the necessity, folks, because we have not been able to bring the airtime bill down, and it keeps ever growing. And ultimately, as I've mentioned, this debt is mine. And I am not in a financial position, actually, even to pay what this is. So I just cannot let it go on any longer. And I want to thank each and every one of you who have supported this broadcast. And as I've said, I know that you've done as much as you can do. And tonight, our guest once again is Alan Watt. And Alan, thanks for being here tonight.
Yes, a pleasure.
Our spiritual message, I want to share this. We were talking last night, you were talking last night, about the religions and the religions of the world. And I had talked about this somewhat on Monday night, although I have heard from several people who said that after I made the announcement that I was going off the air, they weren't able to pick it up for whatever reason. Last night, the reports were that the reception, shortwave reception, was great. But this is about religion, in a sense. It's about faith. Faith is a state of openness or trust. To have faith is like when you trust yourself to the water. You don't grab hold of the water, because if you do, you'll become stiff, you'll become tight, and you'll sink. You have to relax. And the attitude of faith is the very opposite of clinging and holding on. In other words, a person who is fanatic in matters of religion and clings to certain ideas about the nature of God and the universe becomes a person who has no faith at all. Instead, they're holding tight. But the attitude of faith is to let go and become open to truth, whatever it might turn out to be. That was written by Alan Watts, W-A-T-T-S. It's titled The Essential Alan Watts on Faith. And our guest tonight is Alan Watt, not to be confused with the author of this little statement. Lots of Watts around, aren't there, Alan?
There are a few. Yeah.
There are a few. I guess that's quite a common Scottish name, is it?
It's not too common.
Oh, okay. Well, that is irrelevant. And last night we were having a conversation, and I said, darn it, I wish we were having this conversation on the air. And you made a few notes of what you had been talking about, and I would like it if you, I don't know where you'll begin with that, because our conversations do have a tendency to flow from one point to another, and then we get into something that is so relevant. And that was what happened last night in the course of the conversation. Would you like to get started? And
What exactly were we talking about?
You said you were going to make notes, Alan.
I've got a whole pile of papers here.
Okay. Well, we were talking about people who, okay, we where this started, actually, we were talking about archaeology, and I said, you know, that I have seen some... because we don't know when we get these reports that archaeologists have discovered this and archaeologists have discovered that. We don't even know if that's true, because we find out that everything we've been told for the most part is a lie. And I remembered somebody emailing me, and they were skulls, different really weird-looking skulls that were allegedly found, dug up. And I remembered this one, and you had seen it too, and I asked you what you thought about it, and you said that you thought it could have been genetically engineered because of the size of the brain cavity and et cetera. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that's where it started.
Yeah.
And you were talking about how people are bred for their psychological traits.
Yeah.
And lacking certain emotions and certain... And, okay, can you pick that up?
Yeah, I mean, this is... You'll find evidence that the breeding of people for specific functions was perfectly understood just by reading Plato's Republic. And so you go back 2,300-odd years. And Plato, of course, like all of the aristocracy of Greece, had been educated in Egypt. That's where they all went. And so everything he talked about in the Republic came really from Egypt, which had already ruled the world for a few thousand years, the ancient world. And he goes into the methods of selective breeding.
And we want to remember, excuse me, I just want to reiterate this for our listeners, that there were pharaohs, or maybe, I don't know if all of the pharaohs, but they were white, not Egyptian, and some even had red hair.
Yeah, and they found the wigs, of course, in the tombs that they wore, the black wigs made from the native people's hair. And the males and the females of the aristocracy or nobility of Egypt and Sumer wore the black wigs.
What do you think about Cleopatra? Was she one of them?
Well, Cleopatra was actually Greek.
Oh, okay.
She came from the Ptolemy line. And, of course, Ptolemy was a general of Alexander, and he took over the reign of Egypt. And she was descended from the Ptolemies. So, she was definitely white. And,
she was.
And from that type of class.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And if you go back into this breeding program, Plato went through what they'd done with animals, just like today. If you want a domesticated dog for hunting, you know what kind to look at, the types of breeds. If you want one for a faithful pet, there's a whole variety for that. So they all have specific traits. And if you want a guard dog, you know what type to go for. And it's done by literally selectively breeding personality types together for size, strength, and temperament, and that particular psychological trait that you're after. And Plato went through that, and he said we can do exactly the same with people. For the working class, he said that you don't want highly intelligent people, but you do want strength, so you want them short, squat, if you like, muscular. And he went through the methods of simply selecting a male and a female and interbreeding them and then taking their children and doing the same all over again until you had the desired outcome. You said if you want tall ones for picking apples, you make them, you simply select the tall ones and keep interbreeding them. But it's the same thing with psychological traits. That's why they went to such incredible lengths for genealogies for rulers and kings and queens. You want people who have psychopathic traits in so much that they cannot feel empathy for others. And so that part of the brain which is developed in most people that gives us our sociability and our empathy for others, you can actually breed that out of them by selective breeding.
And yes, and that, you said, has to do with different areas of the brain?
Yes, yeah. They knew, in fact, in ancient Egypt, what parts of the brain affected the types of emotion, the areas for taste, smell, and hearing, and so on. They had that all mapped out. In fact, one of the pharaohs wrote one of the first medical books and detailed all of this. So this was well understood, that certain parts of the brain had to do with what we call gifts, like skills in mathematics and so on. So they could, by picking a male and a female who had similar qualities, either increase that ability, or if they wanted to get rid of a particular quality like empathy, or you wouldn't want a soft ruler. You want someone who's hard and cruel if need be. And so you simply breed a male and a female of similar temperaments, and then the same thing with their offspring, and the same thing again until you have the desired types. So when they talk about keeping genealogies of nobility down through the ages, they're not just talking about who their fathers or mothers were, that they're also keeping track of the qualities that they possess.
To know who they wanted to breed with who.
Yeah, for specific types of qualities, yeah. And for nobilities, of course, and kings and queens, you'll find that they have all the temperaments of ego, typically psychopathic. They have tremendous ego, so they love to be praised, they love to have battles and so on and come out on top, but they're never very smart. They're not what you would call terribly intelligent, so they in turn can be manipulated by the priesthoods that
okay.
do all the selection.
Uh-huh.
You see, and that's why kings and queens have all the advisors around them
and presidents
supplies the advisors, just like today. It's no different today. The advisors to presidents and prime ministers are not elected by any public. We're never told where they're trained, and yet we know that they're all trained in the same global tactics, because they all know each other. They all push presidents and prime ministers to go along with the same agenda. So someone appoints these particular people, and they're trained somewhere, but we are told very little about them or their background. But they're far more intelligent than the people that they advise.
And they in turn are taking their directions from someone above them, yes?
Yes, and very high Freemasonry, way above your 33rd. They call these advisors the Grey Men. And the Grey Men, that pertains to the ones who are in touch with those of the earth, the chessboard, the black and the white strips or squares. So they come to the world, or the earthly world, and that's the black basically, but they also go to the light, the one that directs the whole thing. So they're in between presidents and the real controllers, so they're called Grey Men. And Kissinger and the Brzezinskis and these guys, these are the Grey Men. They know a lot more than presidents do, and they're far more intelligent too.
Getting back to those skulls, and then we'll come back to this.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were very weird, and
yeah.
See, so when I looked at them, it was fascinating, intriguing, but I also knew that I didn't know if these actually were skulls that were dug up or if somebody molded them out of, you know, clay.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to tell. But
yeah.
The one, explain the one that you saw and what you thought about it. The one
well,
with the...
You'll actually see, there was a big debate some years ago on the portrait or the paintings and architecture of Akhenaten, who's a big player in high masonry. They modeled the Moses story after Akhenaten, who brought in the one god worship into Egypt. And I don't believe he did, because he was way too young. He was only 15 when it happened. But in the paintings, in the tombs, and also in the frescoes, have found his skull in the painting, and his wife. They have elongated skulls at the back, so the back of the head is elongated, and the children's are too. And of course, then the archaeologist stepped in and said, well, that was just a change from one art style to the next. But they did unearth a lot of the skulls of Akhenaten's family, and sure enough, they have these strange, they're real skulls. They found so many of them.
Those are
in that particular lineage.
Okay, well, the ones that I saw, there wasn't any, like, this is from Akhenaten's line or anything.
Yeah.
But what does this indicate if there is an elongated skull and it's towards the back, did you say? Or towards
yeah,
the front?
Yeah, it's high. The head is high. And the scapular lobe at the back is longer as well.
The forehead is high.
So the whole cortex, really. In other words, there's more brain cells there. There's no doubt about it. And also, if you look closely at the skull, you'll see that they're more roundish towards the front. So it's presumed that they were all given birth by cesarean section. When you go through the birth canal, for instance, you know that the lobes, the parietal lobes, slide over each other in the baby's skull. And it's always been debated how much damage that does. And so a lot of the nobility, not just recent, but...
Unless a woman is... Excuse me. I'm sorry. These thoughts come and I just burst them out. If women are basically built for childbearing...
Yeah.
But there are some women who are narrower hipped and narrower pelvics, where I would think that would be the case. But with a woman who is really built for childbearing, there wouldn't be that kind of damage, would there?
There would still be some, because that still would have to still slide, basically. So
and what is it that slides, Alan?
Well, the skull has two plates, you might say, two main
right.
plates that will slide over each other.
That's where that soft spot is at the top on a baby?
The fontanelle, yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, getting back to this, these guys knew this back in ancient Egypt. And the strange thing was, when you look at the ones that have unearthed in the Aztec lineage, the nobility and kings and queens, they're the same. They've got these same strange elongated skulls, which are also thicker than the normal human skull at the back. Because, again, there was another debate in medicine. Well, was this due to hydrocephalus, which can actually build up spinal fluid?
Fluid, yeah.
But no, because you wouldn't get a thickening off the skull. These skulls, both in the Aztec rulership and in the Egyptian rulership, were both thicker at the back. So it's a strange trait, which could certainly have been done through intense interbreeding for those very those abilities that those people actually possessed.
I recall... This was, I think, during our first, very first broadcast for that five-week period in 98, and I've re-listened to the tapes a couple of times now, but the second time around was extremely fascinating because quite a bit of time had gone between. But I remember you talking about Akhenaten, and you said that he had basically overridden, in a sense, the priesthood, and had brought in the one God, worship of one God, and that he was a very humble person. In other words, he didn't have himself painted or sculpted as a big broad-shouldered, but he had kind of a, you know, squat body and pot belly and
big hips too.
Big hips.
Yeah.
Okay. And
in fact, he had bigger hips than his wife.
Wow. And you said that soon after he died, all of the temples that he had erected for the one God were destroyed, and they went right back to the multiple God worship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was a strange time period, and as I say, he had to have been coached as to what to do, even with the theology to go along with this one God worship. And the God, of course, was the Son. It was the Son that he was talking about. And actually, the Son is a symbol of the light bringer or Lucifer. You have to remember that, too. In all mystic religions, it's always the same. And he had, you'll see pictures of Akhenaten and his wife, and from the Son comes these lines, almost like the lines cast from a ship, and at the end of it you have the Ankh, and that's what an Ankh is. So that's where we get the word anchor from, and the old Egyptian anchor was Ankh shaped. You see, it didn't have the hook at the end as did in later times. So that was a symbol of being anchored to the Lightbringer. But it wasn't for everyone. It was only for a special class of people.
Alan.
Yeah.
Has there ever been a time in the history of this world that you're aware of where people actually didn't have a God that had, you know, human personalities and et cetera, or the Son? I've wondered to myself sometimes, did they worship the Son as representative of the one Creator, given that the Son gives a physical life on this earth?
Mm-hmm. That was one way of see, long before there were rulerships as we know them. You know, people lived in small communities. And everything had a magic to it, a natural magic, and simply meaning a nature of life which they could not understand, but it was wonderful to observe. That's what it meant.
Uh-huh.
And so they didn't build up any theology about it or dogma.
Uh-huh.
But along came the priesthoods and who subverted all of this. And eventually they had them trained in Egypt, and the Mayans did it too, and the Aztecs, that if they didn't, if his priesthood didn't get up in the morning and have enough gifts and money presented, then they wouldn't perform the ceremony that would make the sun rise. You see? So the natural awe that people held for nature in general, for life itself, was subverted and taken over by very intelligent psychopathic types.
The priesthood.
Who then used it against the people and built up dogma and rules and regulations
and created
theology.
Nations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And created nations.
That's right.
I wonder.
And made the people, turned the people into slaves.
Uh-huh. And turned the people into slaves and turned the people into warriors,
yeah,
to protect the nation's borders.
That's
now,
right.
You know, when you first said that,
mm-hmm,
those are concepts that, because I don't know that it occurred to very many of us, how did nations come about?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't necessarily buy into it, but it was an interesting thought, especially when you explain the meaning of the word international. It means inter, to bury, the nations.
Yeah.
And yet they, in the writings of the elite, those who call themselves Jews, they say that they were the ones that created the nations. And of course, they weren't the ones, but somebody asked me, after that broadcast, and you were talking about what it was like before the priesthood was in control, or in areas where they got control, and that that was the most natural way of living. And somebody emailed me and said, is he insinuating that we all need to go back to the cave days? I said, maybe so. Maybe so, maybe not cave days.
Well, he's a paradox. He's a paradox for everybody. And it's the meaning of see, the Bible in the Old Testament is allegory, is Masonic allegory. And everything, every story in it is an allegory for something else, which is well understood by those near the top. And so Eden represents nature in its pure state. And if you're not content with nature in its pure state, and you leave nature and you put your faith in science, you see? Because once you leave the place where everything is there that you need, and you become dependent on specialists,
mm-hmm.
where it's a blacksmith or whatever, then there's only one path from Eden, and it leads eventually to where we're going in the future, the very actually now. It leads to the extinction of the human will, the human mind,
uh-huh.
and independent thinking.
And in the villages,
mm-hmm.
Where there were clans and etc., they had tool makers,
mm-hmm.
people who seemed to be more gifted in that area. They had their healers,
yeah.
people who knew the herbs to use for medicine and etc.,
mm-hmm.
and their quote holy men or women. And these were women who took a lot of time alone for contemplation and not to coin a phrase, but spiritual enlightenment, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was all there within the village. And each person
yeah.
had different talents.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all shared.
Yeah. Yeah, because the strength of the tribe depended on everyone being involved. No one went hungry, for instance, and they didn't have the moneyed work ethic, a different type of work ethic, where the individual who accumulates has the right to dominate the rest. That didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, up into the 1700s in the Highlands of Scotland, you'll find that iron nails were still exchanged as a form of money. It was more important to them to have something that was useful.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, they had the rebellion then, and that was all arranged because they had to destroy that old system. And they did. They cleared the Highlands. You know.
The rebellion being a revolution.
Well, they sent over Prince Charles, who. He was over in France at the time, and they sent him over, and he led a revolution which failed. I think it was intended to fail, and everybody, no one knew except him, I'm sure. And then they used that as an excuse to clear the Highlands, even though only a few clans took part.
Would you hold that thought?
Yeah.
We're at the half hour. We're going to take a break here. Ladies and gentlemen, the broadcast has been brought to you by you for 8 years, and even though we go off the air, I'm suggesting that possibly, if you can, you might wish to continue helping to tear down this nearly $12,000 airtime debt that we have. If you'll take my address down.
What in the world is going on? Stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com to find out first. And on satellite at Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70.
If you read the history books, the most often asked question to Southerners was this: why did you fight? And the most often given answer is, because you're here. In other words, the South did not invade the North invaded the South.
Was it the Civil War or War of Federal Aggression? John Weaver sets the record straight in this DVD series on the Civil War and the Right of Succession from the Old Pass Christian History Conference. Was there a war to set the slaves free, or was it a war to enslave us all? Get this DVD and judge for yourself. War of Federal Aggression. Get this DVD presentation for a donation of $25 from FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Order online today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Call 559-781-3773. The truth seems strange only because we've been indoctrinated with a fiction. War of Federal Aggression. Get it today. You have been listening to Jackie Petrou's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the internet at firstamendmentradio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, P.A. 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, P.A. 16936. Be sure to visit the SweetLiberty.org website. Thank you for your continued support. And stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Okay, we're back with Alan Watt, folks. You were mentioning the uprising in Scotland.
Yes,
Alan,
a handful of clans followed the Bonnie Prince Charlie, as they called him, Charles Stuart.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived in a place called Culloden for a while, where that last battle took place, and he led them there. He went off a couple of miles away into a Culloden house for the night and left them on this bog. It was an actual bog. And they got up in the morning early because the British Army, and it was British because there was Scottish regiments, southern Scottish regiments there too. So they were all arranged with a cannon and firing away for about 5 hours before Charles gave the order to charge. And it turned out that Charles had scampered. He hadn't even arrived on the battlefield. And he escaped back to France and then to Italy. So they were left as a sacrifice. Interestingly enough, there's a story involved with this that tells you how the future is planned. It truly is planned. Because there was in Scotland you have these seers, they call them. And one of them was called the Brehon Seer, who could see into the future.
Oh, a seer, like an orb.
A seer who could actually see the future.
Oh, seer.
Uh-huh.
Gotcha.
And the Brehon Seer lived in the 1500s. And when he was... And I read the original book in a library from the 1500s. And he did say that when he was passing... what became Culloden. It was called Dromossi at that time, Dromossi Moor. He said that woe, he says, for Dromossi Moor will be the death of the flower of Scotland, as he called it. The flower of Scotland is a young man, that's what that means. And just before the battle, about a year before the battle, it was officially changed on the maps that Dromossi Moor to Culloden, which is the culling of Odin, you see, because the old clans still had the Odin as their deity.
The culling of Odin?
Yep.
Now, yep. How long before this happened was this written, that the seer said this?
About 200 odd years. So that's how things are planned. We're taught and trained and indoctrinated to believe that life we just bumble along,
yeah.
And politicians stumble through crises that they can't foresee, and nothing can be further from the truth. Because when you go into history, you'll find very elite sects of people writing about the future because they belong to organizations which planned the future. And of course, you'll find the whole globalization effort with all of what we now think of as the UN agendas interfering with all phases of our life. You'll find Cecil Rhodes and his secret society, and then followed up by Lord Milner, who then ran it with the roundtables, They wrote about it, and Carl Quigley documented most of it in his two main books, Tragedy and Hope. And he wrote another one that's called The Anglo-American Establishment, where he gives you the names of the big players, the big families that are involved in this, and where they thought they could bring us. If you go into the writings of Lenin in the early 1900s, he said towards the end of the millennium, we shall see a global society come into view. Lord Bertrand Russell said the same thing around 1920.
And Lenin
so these
was...
guys knew exactly the timelines that they were working on with 5, 10, 20, 50, 100-year plans. And if you look into the United Nations today, they're still working on those same types of schedules with 50 and 100-year plans.
I was doing some searching today in the Internet, mm-hmm. seeing if I could come up with that meeting that you were talking about, uh-huh. meetings that they had been having, UN environmental meetings
yeah.
in Texas, relating to water and septic and et cetera.
Yeah.
And Border Region 20 is now called Border 2012.
Yeah. And right now...
Or Border Region 21, I guess it was. Whatever. Mm-hmm. It's now 2012.
Uh-huh. And right now, they're having an Earth Summit in Alaska. And we know what happened from the last Earth Summit. It was a tremendous impact on all. Are we all living with the environment and so on?
No, I didn't know about that.
Yeah, so these things are ongoing, continue, and actually they're speeding them up. But as I say, Lord Milner and Cecil Rhodes and Lord Rothschilds and all these guys who helped set up the secret society that they formed with, again, it was a high Masonic society with passwords and so on, they wrote about what's happened in our lifetimes. They helped bring on World War II, and Carl Quigley documents that very, very well from the records of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which the Cecil Rhodes and Milner group set up. And the American branch is called the CFR.
And you can go back 100 years to the protocols.
Yeah.
And it is so eerie what they said 100 years ago and how they were going to do what they were going to do and how it has been done, even to the point of saying, we're going to give the president the authority to declare war.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's never been given the authority other than by those advisors who say, yes, you should do this, and yes, you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
But that is happening today.
Well, even the New American Century document that was published in the 90s, and drawn up by Wolfowitz and Cheney and that bunch, and that's a private organization at that time. They had the whole war, which countries they were going to invade, beginning with Afghanistan, and then Iraq, and then Iran and Syria. And so they had all the countries mapped out in advance. You know? And then they went and did it. So sure, and then Brzezinski's book came out called The Grand Chessboard in the late 90s, and he said we need something on the scale of a Pearl Harbor situation to motivate the American public behind us for those countries we wish to go to war with.
Yes.
And lo and behold, things always seem to happen in their favor.
Yes, and then there was Kissinger.
Mm-hmm.
I watched and listened to this man within a couple of hours of 911,
yeah.
And he said this is an attack just like Pearl Harbor, and we need to address it in the same way.
Yes, uh-huh. And immediately, too, Brzezinski was on television saying we should go to war with Iraq, you know. And you know, most people today that have done polls in Canada and the States, and they published them in the newspapers here, most people in the U.S. think now, because of all the propaganda by the media, they've forgotten that Afghanistan was supposed to be the hiding place for the Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And, and have come to believe that, that Saddam Hussein was responsible for the attack, even though I've got it on videotape during the inquiry where George Bush said, he says, no, I never said that we were attacking Iraq because Saddam had anything to do with blowing up the towers. He said I went into Iraq, he said, because the world's a better place without him.
Oh, my.
So, that you know, but the public truly have been brainwashed by retrospective propaganda by the media to believe that Saddam Hussein was responsible.
Well, I recall maybe that was a process, because I can remember them saying, first of all, it was Afghanistan, because that's where Osama bin Laden was hanging out, and they had to go in there and find him and the terrorists.
Yeah.
And the next thing you know, Saddam Hussein was harboring terrorists.
That's right.
Now, Al-Qaeda was not associated with Saddam Hussein, or with bin Laden, was he?
Well, Al-Qaeda was a term the CIA gave them.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the CIA had formed and sponsored and funded and trained these groups when Afghanistan was occupied by the Russians. So they trained
yes.
them and formed them to do what
yes.
they did.
Yes, Osama bin Laden was a CIA asset.
That's right, and he's a member of the nobility of Saudi Arabia.
And for any newer listeners, Osama bin Laden's family was very closely connected and in business with the Bushes.
And that they did documentaries on the CBC on that. In fact, on the very day that the towers went down, Bush Sr. was at a meeting with the Laden family.
Yes, and they were flown safely out of the States, I understand.
That was the only aircraft allowed to fly the following day.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
And then Osama bin Laden was the bad guy.
Yeah. That's correct. It's just amazing how they play these tricks with us.
Yes.
And
I'd like to bring this up a little bit to closer to today, if we could.
Yeah.
Because something I'd like you to share, if you would, with our listeners. Well, I had a call from Jerry in Wisconsin, and she was very interested when, at the end of the broadcast last night, we were talking just briefly about rural cleansing.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing, and I will say this once again, because I couldn't understand, I didn't doubt that they intend to move people out of the countries into the cities.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what really clinched it for me was that in the Old Testament, after they took all the people's grain and made them pay for it, and, mm-hmm. and then created a depression, and then they had no money, so they had to give away their flocks and to the Pharaoh, and finally they sold themselves and their children into slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And it says right in there that Joseph gathered the people up from the country and took them into the cities.
Yeah.
And anyway, I couldn't figure out how are they going to do this. How, you know, just say, okay, you can't live here anymore. Well, now we're experiencing rural cleansing. Besides the rewilding, they're already, you know, getting their playgrounds ready.
Yeah.
But here in the rural areas, first of all, we have rural electric, rural gas, and there are all these, oh, we can't make any money. For example, my heating bill for natural gas. And Pennsylvania is natural gas rich. In fact, we're in a natural gas pocket where we live. And yet, they keep taking these hikes, of course.
Yeah.
Last year, it got to the point where I had to go on the budget plan, and it budgeted out to $191 a month throughout the year, when during the summertime, my bill was running maybe $27 to $38 a month. And so that I got close to $400 in some months. I received a notice from the gas company that according to my usage last year, the budget plan for my monthly will go up to $247 a month. And when I called them, basically I got the same story that I did the first time I called about this. Oh, well, we can't make a profit. It's against the law. Well, then why are the rates so high? Well, it's our suppliers. We get our gas from all over the country. I said, what about Pennsylvania? Why don't we get it here? It must cost buku tons of money. to pipe gas from countries all over this country, or excuse me, states. And I have to go to the Energy Commission or something like that in order to get answers to that. But so our costs of electricity have risen. We took a rate raise, she said, in September, and there's going to be another one in December. And the electricity has gone up. And they are raising our property taxes every single year. And, of course, that's happening at a local level. And it doesn't matter if people swarm these county commissioners, township supervisors. They do it. They just absolutely do it. And I still think that a damn good, excuse my vernacular, but tarring and feathering, and I don't mean scalding somebody with hot tar, but it seems like it has stopped someplace. But then you look at the prices of gasoline for the cars. And so in the rural areas, I've heard people actually talking about maybe not being able to afford to keep their jobs because the gas that it's going to cost them to get to their jobs, yeah, they'll wind up making nothing. And I suddenly thought it's rural cleansing.
Yeah.
It is.
All this was discussed in the Kyoto conference.
Uh-huh.
And they said that they reiterated really what had been said before by the UN many times, that they want to bring North America back to the energy consumption of the 1960s.
Yeah.
And that's what they're doing. This is all to do with the Kyoto.
Oh, and I saw an article about bicycles and how many hundreds of thousands of people. There have been a few million, I guess,
yeah,
that are switching to bicycles. I have an article here from 1950s, a newspaper article or a report. It could have been a report on a political agenda that they intend to get the people out of their cars and riding bicycles.
Yeah,
and here we are.
China is the model state for all of this.
Yeah.
But what China or the main cities there don't get is lots of snow, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And they won't let us use spikes on our bicycle tires here because it churns up the road, you see.
Sure.
I guess we'll be skating to work, maybe. Or
yeah.
Skiing to work.
And we had a conversation quite a few weeks ago. One of our listeners here in Pennsylvania was telling you that in his county, and it's actually a county right next to this one,
uh-huh,
it was a road that was not really heavily traveled. One accident occurred on that road about 7 years ago, or one accident in 7 years,
mm-hmm,
and yet they've lined the highway for miles with guardrails.
Yeah.
And what you kind of figured out, you said, you know, because they're talking about these all-terrain vehicles, or the SUVs.
That's right. I used to wonder why on earth the SUV they're attacking so much. Then you realize that when you look at the recent events in New Orleans and in Texas,
relocation, yes,
everyone has to stay on the same highways. They don't want people wandering off. So whatever is coming down the pike, they don't want people with the ability to drive off the road through the country, you know.
Because the guardrails aren't on any particular slopes.
That's right.
They're just. And how many miles did he say this guardrail went?
I don't know, but it was just the fact that it was done so quickly for no real reason.
Yeah.
Local governments don't spend money like that. In fact, generally, when it's something that's necessary, it's hard to get them to act at all. But this wasn't necessary, so there's other reasons behind it. And I think whatever is coming, they're going to want people staying on certain roads as they herd us all into where we're supposed to,
yeah,
go.
Well, you know, it occurs to me we could have a, quote, unnatural disaster here,
mm-hmm,
in the area where they say, okay, you know, we have to get you out of here for your own safety.
Uh-huh.
And it does make sense,
yeah,
that those SUVs would easily be able to drive off a country road,
yeah,
through a field, even through light woods, you know, if they've,
oh,
got,
yeah,
trails,
mm-hmm,
and they don't have to stay with the pack, with the herd.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, in New Orleans, I don't know if the public are still aware, they still have road checks all over the place. Every so many miles, you come up to roadblocks, and you show your ID and all the rest of it. That's still going on right now.
I told you, I mentioned last night about the lady that was here with friends, not here in my place, but in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And she tried to go back, if I recall, and she was turned away. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't know when she can go back, and her home wasn't even flooded.
Yeah.
But she was ousted at gunpoint. Uh-huh. And I really would love to know what is happening in New Orleans or in that area. Now, I'm not asking for calls this evening, but listeners who might have, because, Alan, it's been quiet.
I know. It dropped it all together.
I know, but usually on the Internet, there are reports from people, you know, people who live in the area or et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I still get a slew of emails, and those I pull up when they come in. Those are the ones that I want to take a look at. And it's just been so quiet
mm-hmm.
that you just don't know what's been going on there.
No, I know. So it's it's a huge training exercise for sure for the military and the police and the multi-jurisdictional task force. They're all one now. They're all one fraternity, they were called on the main media here. One brotherhood is another term they used on this.
The brotherhood of police?
Police and military. Uh-huh.
Yeah, oh
international
my.
Brotherhood of police and military.
Mm.
That was said.
Yeah. They have had for a long time. And this is so amazing when you think how slick they are. They have the, let's say, a county association of police,
mm-hmm.
Police chiefs. They'll have then a state, then they'll have the national association,
mm-hmm.
and the international association.
That's right.
And they have the international association of mayors.
And they all are international, which means they're registered with the United Nations.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. And they have their own publications that are sent round to the police chiefs all over the world, and they promote the agenda. And if they promote the agenda, they know they not only stay in their job, but they'll get well rewarded for it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I read a book, and it was a very intriguing book. It's been a few years ago. And it followed this one particular police chief, and he went from one state, Alan,
uh-huh.
to another.
Yeah.
He kept showing up in other states, very corrupt, very evil. And he would leave after things would get so hot,
uh-huh.
and then the next thing you know, he's a police chief in another state someplace.
Yeah. I'd like to say, though, I tuned in one Sunday through the shortwave. I was scanning the shortwave, and The FM stations in New Orleans have got together because of the damage, so they've got together as an amalgam, a temporary amalgamation, and they're broadcasting on shortwave at certain times during the day on 15.825. And the last one that I listened into, it was the reporters and the media from those stations getting an update from the FEMA representatives there. So you get it live as it happens on 15.825.
15.825.
Yeah.
And it's various times throughout the day?
Yeah, the rest of the time it's religion, but then it comes in and it will tell you it's called WWL. That's one of the FM stations. URBC is the other one. And there's another one, three of them together, in fact. But they're broadcasting on the shortwave, and that's where you get the news from, straight from there.
Yeah, but do you think it's actual real stuff you're getting?
That's what the people in that area are receiving themselves on their FM stations. They're simultaneously broadcasting it on the shortwave.
But why would we think that they're getting the truth, Alan?
Well, I know. And in fact, that's what they did show you, was that it was a question-answer thing. So you heard that the answers that FEMA were giving to the press. Yeah. And it's up to the individual to suss it out, sort of thing.
All
right. It's a huge exercise with FEMA totally in control.
I'd like to give my home phone number. Folks, when I give the number for the call-in here of the broadcast, it ends in 3025. I would like to give my actual phone number of the house phone, so so that I'll hear it anywhere in the house. And any of you who live in that area who can give us any updates, I would really appreciate it. It's 570-537-3035-3035. Same numbers as the call in here, but it's 3035, not 3025. And Alan, we're just about out of time. Mm-hmm. We do have next week coming up. I'm going to be talking to Darren Weeks, our webmaster, and I would like to invite Darren to come on with us next week for one or two days, but I'm thinking it would be appropriate as much time as you've given mm-hmm. and as much enlightenment that you've brought to us to invite you to come on Wednesday night, uh-huh. which would be our last broadcast night.
Yeah.
If you would like to do that. I want to give your address, folks, if you would write this down. I don't know if they can hear you better or me, Alan.
On you go, because there's not much time.
Okay. It's Alan Watt, W-A-T-T, folks, and it's site, S-I-T-E, 41, Box 4. It is in Astaire, like Fred Astaire, with an E, E-S-T-A-I-R-E, Astaire, Ontario, and that is Canada. The postal code is P as in Peter, 3, E as in Elizabeth, 4, N as in Nora, 1, P3E4N1, that's Canada. His books are $25 each. There are three of them. If you get one at a time, start with number 1. It has to be an international money order or cash. He cannot use a U.S. Money order, nor can he cash a personal check. His phone number is 705-695-0416. Did I do it right, Alan? Okay, folks, we'll be back with you Monday. And thank you for being here. And Alan, thank you for being here. Good night. Good night, folks, and God bless you.
You have been listening to Jackie Petrou's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the internet at firstamendmentradio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Be sure to visit the sweetliberty.org website. Thank you for your continued support. And stay tuned to firstamendmentradio.com.
The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests, and not necessarily those of the First Amendment Radio Network or its affiliated radio stations.
Now listen to me. The Bible says, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. I want you to know that a corporation is Caesar.
Government takeover of the church. This DVD is the most powerful tool we have for waking up those asleep.